Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Eunjung Cho.
This week, we'll take a look at the environment and how pollution across the globe is affecting life here in the United States.
A lot of it has to do with the increased anthropogenic activity, industrial activity in Eastern Asia.
Also, what can moss in Antarctica tell us about climate change?
Can bamboo bikes help protect the environment and reduce poverty?
We'll meet some Jamaican musicians who are touring the world with their unique brand of sacred music.
And Chris Hart is an American singer who is a sensation in Japanese pop music. That's all coming up on Now. Some students in St. Louis, Missouri, are part of a unique project funded by the U.S. space agency, NASA.
The students are using sophisticated instruments flown in weather balloons to measure ozone levels in our atmosphere.
As Veronique LaCapra tells us now, scientists hope to learn more about the role that ozone plays, both good and bad, in our lives.
Background number one, 0.02, correct?
Yes.
Pump efficiency file default, serial number of IMAT
A small group of St. Louis University students are huddled around a laptop and radio receiver set up outside the St. Louis Science Center Planetarium. They're getting ready to participate in a NASA mission to measure ozone, a gas that both protects and pollutes the planet. That's the sound of data. Inside a small styrofoam box are a GPS and two little instruments that measure temperature, humidity, air pressure, and ozone. A transmitter in the box broadcasts the data to a 2-meter-tall antenna connected to that beeping radio receiver. From there, an old-school modem translates the audio signal into ones and zeros that the laptop converts into air quality measurements. Once the students have checked that all the equipment is working, the next step is to attach the styrofoam box with its instruments to a weather balloon that will carry everything up into the atmosphere. But first, they need to fill the balloon with helium. A lot of helium. Fully blown up, the balloon will be 2 to 3 meters in diameter. The goal is to give it enough lift to carry it and its cargo up about 30 kilometers into the stratosphere. That's about 3 times as high as commercial jets fly.
This is Gary Morris with the St. Louis University Weather Balloon Launch Team at the St. Louis Planetarium. We're 5 minutes from a weather balloon launch.
Gary Morris is checking in with air traffic controllers at the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. He's a professor at Valparaiso University in Indiana and the lead trainer for the NASA Ozone Balloon Project. St. Louis is one of 7 sites from Colorado to Florida involved in the nationwide study. Morris says NASA wants to get more data on ozone because of the important roles it plays in our atmosphere, both good and bad. High up in the stratosphere, the ozone layer absorbs sunlight and keeps harmful ultraviolet radiation from reaching the Earth. But down near the ground, emissions from sources like petrochemical plants and cars can form ozone pollution and smog, which can exacerbate respiratory problems like asthma.
And it's especially difficult on children who are still developing. So children who grow up in areas that are chronically exposed to high levels of ozone have more frequent rates of asthma.
St. Louis University's ozone study is being led by Jack Fishman, who worked for NASA for more than 30 years studying air pollution and atmospheric chemistry. He says while regulations have led to lower ozone pollution in urban areas of the U.S., ozone levels outside of cities have continued to rise.
A lot of it has to do with the increased anthropogenic activity, industrial activity in Eastern Asia.
He says that's because pollution is being blown across the Pacific by global air currents in the upper atmosphere.
So we've crossed the threshold of increasing ozone concentrations whereby we actually see enough ozone in the atmosphere that crop growth is inhibited, forest growth is being impeded.
In 2010, Fishman published a study showing that ozone damage to the U.S. soybean crop alone may cost farmers hundreds of millions of dollars each year. And he says that like carbon dioxide, ozone absorbs heat and affects climate.
So this project is trying to understand the complexity of the chemistry and the clouds and other processes, meteorological processes, that impact local meteorology, which in turn form the big picture of climate and in turn climate change.
Okay, we're all good. Ready?
Back at the St. Louis Science Center, it's launch time.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, lift off! All right.
The balloon and its payload swoop upwards. St. Louis University senior William Iwasco is one of four undergraduates on the launch team. He says launching the weather balloons by the planetarium in a public park gives kids who come by a chance to see science in action.
And it helps to sort of build their excitement for science and especially meteorology, so we hope we're developing little meteorologists here.
7-year-old Zach Crawford says when he grows up, he wants to be a fireman. But the balloon launch definitely made an impression.
That was amazing. It's so high that I can't even see it.
The Ozone Balloon Project runs through the end of September. For VOA News, I'm Veronique LaCapra in St. Louis.
The rugged mountain peninsula that juts from the west coast of Antarctica is one of the most rapidly warming places on the planet.
With temperature increases as much as 3 degrees Celsius, the once stable sea ice is retreating.
As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel tells us, a new study also finds unprecedented ecological change in response to a warmer climate.
Unlike the rest of the frozen continent, the Antarctic Peninsula has a summer melt season. It's here that Jessica Royal studies the snow-free zones, especially the moss that blankets the landscape. She's a biologist with Cambridge University and the British Antarctic Survey, the organization charged with Britain's scientific work in Antarctica.
The moss is really the dominant plant growing in this area, and it accumulates in these moss banks from when the moss starts growing up to the present day, so it can provide a really good record of changes in the past that have been preserved in the moss.
What was the purpose of your study? What question did you ask?
We wanted to know how moss growth rate, how the conditions for growth, and how the microbial populations had changed over the course of the 150 years where this particular moss growth was accumulating.
To answer that question, Royals and her team looked at moss cores extracted from this remote and largely inaccessible region.
What we found is that it started growing around the year 1860, so it's about 150 years ago, and it's been growing and accumulating throughout the period up to the present day. But that around 1960, the growth rate really rapidly increased, up to a maximum of between 5 and 6 millimeters a year.
Microbes in the moss also multiplied rapidly over the same time frame. Royals attributes the ecological change to warmer temperatures, increased rainfall, and stronger winds.
It's showing us that really that both the plants and the microbes are really very sensitive to the climate changes that have been happened over the last 50 years, and that over the time that this moss bank has been growing, that those changes are unprecedented.
Further north on the Antarctic Peninsula, Royals continues her analysis of moss banks that date back more than 5,000 years.
So we can now use those moss banks as paleoarchives of past changes in the environment and how they might have occurred. And every little bit of understanding of how both physical climate change and the biological responses to that adds to our understanding of our climate system.
Anne Royals adds a scenario in which the polar flora and fauna track the projected warmer temperatures would fundamentally change the ecology and appearance of Antarctica. Her study appears in Current Biology, a Cell Press publication. We have a virtual tour of the moss sites visited by the British Antarctic Survey, led by Jessica Royals, at voanews.com. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Eungjun, do you ride a bicycle?
Unfortunately, I don't, and I'm quite shameful about that.
Why?
Because, you know, everybody does.
Everybody does. Now, see, I have a bicycle, but I don't ride it. Not because I don't want to, but because of time. The bicycle that I have is made out of steel. It's what's called a hybrid. It's relatively heavy. It's not one of these carbon fiber things like they ride in the Tour de France. It's made out of steel, so it's heavy. But there's a social entrepreneur that we're about to meet who has made high-end bicycles out of bamboo.
Wow.
From Manila, reporter Jason Strother introduces us to Brian Benitez McClellan, whose company turns locally sourced bamboo into high-end bike frames.
Brian Benitez McClellan is passionate about bicycles. When the 29-year-old Filipino-American heads out onto the streets of Makati City, he grabs his bike. But his is made of bamboo.
Bamboo is a pretty incredible material. In the plant kingdom, you know, it grows really rapidly and absorbs tons of carbon dioxide. So from that perspective, it's a very renewable resource. And then in a performance level, it's got the characteristics of naturally vibration dampening pole structures, which really absorb the road chatter and road buzz and make for a super smooth ride.
In 2010, McClellan founded Bambike, a company that turns locally sourced bamboo into bike frames. The Bambike workshop is located in the countryside in the town of Victoria, 130 kilometers from Metro Manila. Out here, the bamboo is harvested from farms and the wild. Bambike's workers cut, treat, and process the material into specialized bike frames. The finished products are not cheap. They start at around $1,200, but McClellan says much of the profit goes back into this poor community.
Where we can produce world-class certified bamboo bicycles for the global market while keeping jobs at home here in the rural provincial areas so that the workers can stay with their families and have gainful employment.
Many of the municipality's 60,000 inhabitants work in rice farming, but that is not a year-round job. McClellan and Victoria's mayor, Candido Guillaume, see the mutual benefits of working together. Already, some of Victoria's farmers are planting bamboo propagules or seedlings.
We pay them 15 pesos, and that's good enough for them. And the good thing is, after producing the propagules, we bring them back this bamboo and plant it in their own backyard. So in the near future, for 3 years, hopefully, they can cut it up and make money out of it.
Brian Benitez McClellan visits one of the bamboo nurseries the town supports. He says in just a couple years, this plant will be strong enough to be harvested.
Bamboo is arguably the greenest building material on earth. Bamboo is as strong as steel if you use the right species. It's very durable, really strong, and can stand up to the demands needed by a bicycle frame.
McClellan says bamboo can be used to build a lot more than just bike frames. He hopes Bambike is just the start of a bamboo revolution in the Philippines. Jason Strother for VOA News, Victoria.
Coming up on Now, Chris Hart fell in love with Japan as a child. Now he's a household name in J-pop. 'Cause all we got is right now,
Throughout the ages and around the globe, drumming has been used for communication, entertainment, and for prayer.
That's especially true for Rastafarians, an African-based spiritual ideology that arose in the 1930s in Jamaica.
From New York, Gail Wine introduces us to Drums of Defiance, who are using their music to spread their faith.
If you haven't heard of Nyabingi drumming, you're not alone. It's sacred music, played as a communal meditative practice in the Rastafarian religion of Jamaica, and rarely performed in public. As Jamaican reggae star Vivian Jones explains, it is a centuries-old link between the Caribbean and Africa.
That's been in Jamaica since we were taken there as slaves. Slave master used to pan the drums. So the drums was there from the time we land on that island, you know, the drums were being played. So it was African drumming. It's all the way from ancient Ethiopia. That same name. All it did was it travel in the slave ship to Jamaica, and then it bloom and blossom again in Jamaica.
It's a form of music passed down from generation to generation. Drummer Banjo Ayapingi Noah says he started early.
You know, I grew up playing within the church. You know, before the elders would come and play, we, the children, we have to play. So we learned this all from the elders. The elders sit us down and even teach us what to sing.
Banjo plays with Drums of Defiance, a band of Jamaican musicians based in London. He says that although this is sacred music, the band is now beginning to perform it in public to spread the teachings of the Rastafarians.
And I was even thinking it was wrong for me to even record it. You know, that's why it's only now that I'm really going into really say I'm going to make an Ayabingi album, because the way I was seeing it is from the church. You see it. But now, you know, as I said before, the teachings have to go everywhere. Everyone have to know what Rastafari is. You see it? And through the power of Ayabingi.
For their performance at the Jerusalem Sacred Music Festival, the band members are seated on stage. Some are dressed in white, and some are clad in vivid reds, yellows, and greens, with long flowing robes and colorful headgear. The musicians' chanting often follows the call and response pattern that is typical of gospel and other genres of music whose roots are in Africa. Biblical Israel is a core topic in much of gospel and reggae music. So when Vivian Jones had the chance to perform at the annual festival in Jerusalem, he didn't hesitate. He invited the Drums of Defiance to join him.
Ja Rastafari. We'll do one more, yes? By the rivers of Babylon.
Ayabingi drumming is ceremonial music for Rastafarians, but it's also universal, as Jones explains.
This music that we play, this music is a music of love and of upliftment. Mm-hmm. This music is for the whole world, it's for all nations, it's for us to get together. This music will draw everyone together, all nations together, and we're not singing of war, we're singing of peace, we're singing of love. We're singing of caring for your one another, your family. This is what we're singing about. So.
Jones and the Drums of Defiance plan to take performances of Ayabingi music around the world. For VOA News, I'm Gail Wine reporting.
You could say that music is in Chris Hart's blood.
Chris's father played jazz bass, and his mother was a classically trained pianist.
Growing up in San Francisco, California, Chris was trained in music from an early age, so it might not surprise you that he is a successful musician.
But the kind of music he chose might not be something you would predict looking at the African-American singer. Chris Hart is a household name in Japanese pop music, or J-pop.
Chris was first exposed to the Japanese language when he took a class at age 12. Then he fell in love with the country, the language, and the people.
He visited Japan when he was 13, staying in a home in Tsukuba City. Chris says that stay ignited his passion for all things Japanese.
You know, as my main goal was to live in Japan more than anything else, that was the first step. And then once I got here, I just kind of took my time to get, you know, used to the culture, get used to living in Japan for the first time. And from there, it was just kind of gradual steps back into music.
When he got back to the United States, Chris started a rock band that performed Japanese songs. He also worked as a police officer and as a clerk in a cosmetics company. Then he got to go back to Japan in 2009 when he took a job with a vending machine company. And he continued to sing. And Chris also uploaded videos of his music on YouTube, where he had many followers.
So, I mean, it really became just a part of my daily routine without much thinking about it. It was just kind of like one day I got into Japanese music because I'd always been doing music. And then from there, it was just, you know, I want to get back to Japan, and I want to keep doing music, so just keep going and see what happens.
Eventually, Chris got invited to sing on the Japanese television show Nodo Jiman Za World, where foreigners compete in karaoke.
Chris blew away the judges, many of them J-pop singers themselves, and won the show with his rendition of the song Home.
Chris Hart says that he loves the emotional and personal focus of Japanese pop music.
But I think here, more than how well you sing your songs comes down to how well you present your songs and how well you relate to your audience. So idols are really big here because they relate with a broad number of people who are just looking to, you know, for those kind of characters.
Chris Hart's version of Home was released in May and reached number 13 on the Oricon music charts. That's the Japanese equivalent of Billboard.
His first album, Heart Song, made it to number 3 on the Oricon charts.
That's quite an achievement in the $4.42 billion Japanese music industry, especially since Japan has about half the population of the United States.
Chris Hart told the Associated Press his next step is to release some original songs and to continue covering J-pop songs from other singers.
So what do you think? Have you heard of Chris Hart? Do you like J-pop? You can let us know by sending an email by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com. And now here's Chris Hart with his version of Home. And speaking of email, we got a note from Mickey Saw, a student in chemical engineering at Kyunghee University.
Mickey writes, I have improved my English ability with the help of VOA News. I download many VOA News podcasts in my portable player. I found a new interesting program now last month. I can listen to stories of inspiring people in the world and keep up with the trend.
He also said he was happy that one of our co-hosts, Eungjung Cho, is Korean. Eungjung, you have a fan club.
David, that's exaggeration, but I'm very happy to hear from Mickey, and I'm so glad to hear that we have audience in South Korea.
If you have any questions or comments about our show, you can email us by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com. You can also send us a tweet. Our address on Twitter is @NowVOAShow.
Patrice Martin produced our program today.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until next time, I'm Eunjung Cho.
And I'm David Byrd. Join us again for the next edition of Now.